Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and Friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Dr. James Weiner, author of the new book, The Quest for Legitimacy: How Children of Prominent Families Discover Their Unique Place in the World. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. It's the 4th of July tomorrow, the 246th anniversary of our nation's official birth, American Independence Day. That makes this a good time on 2 Jewish to remember the role that we Jews played in the American Revolution back in 1776, the 7 years of the War of Independence. You know, real independence wasn't guaranteed until the British surrendered at Yorktown in 1781, and the subsequent Treaty of Paris took 2 more years. It was in 1783 that the U.S. officially was created as a country. Important Jewish leaders like Chaim Solomon helped birth the American Revolution. There were American volunteers in the Continental Army. And we could, of course, extend this discussion of Jewish leadership in the United States throughout all the rest of American history. But as long as we're on the subject of the 4th of July, we really have to play this unique tribute.
I'm singing you the ballad of a great man of the cloth. His name was Harry Lewis, and he worked for Irving Roth. He died while cutting velvet. On a hot July the 4th, but his cloth goes shining on.
Glory, glory, Harry Lewis. Glory, glory, Harry Lewis. Glory, glory, Harry Lewis. His cloth goes shining on.
Oh, Harry Lewis perished. In the service of his Lord, he was trampling through the warehouse where the drapes of Roth are stored. He had the finest funeral the Union could afford, and his cloth goes shining on.
Glory, glory, Harry Lewis. Glory, glory, Harry Lewis. Glory, glory, Harry Lewis. His cloth goes shining.
That was the late, great comedian Alan Sherman's incredible The Ballad of Harry Lewis, including one of the great puns in the history of parody. He was trampling through the warehouse where the drapes of Roth are stored. A still entertaining take on American patriotism is viewed through the lens, or perhaps the curtains, of the Jewish prevalence in the shmata business, the garment industry. You know, I really enjoy the 4th of July, especially watching fireworks displays. John Adams, our nation's first vice president and second president, famously said, "The second day of July, 1776, will be the most memorable epoch in the history of America. I am apt to believe it will be celebrated by succeeding generations as the great anniversary festival. It ought to be commemorated as the day of deliverance by solemn acts of devotion to God Almighty. It ought to be solemnized with pomp and parade, with shows, games, sports, guns, bells, bonfires, and illuminations from one end of this continent to the other, from this time forward forevermore." Adams was off on the calendar by 2 days, since the formal signing of the Declaration of Independence turned out to be after the original passing of that declaration, July 2nd. And the celebrations now also go well beyond the continent, all the way out to the Hawaiian Islands. I once spent the 4th of July watching fireworks on Kauai. But otherwise, John Adams basically had it right. Every 4th of July ever since 1776 has been commemorated with fireworks, parades, and pageants. Well, everyone except those coronavirus years, when these were pretty much limited to virtual events. But we are back to celebrating the 4th fully this year. Now, that's not to say that every expression of patriotism is exactly healthy or honest. I believe those people who fly a couple of American flags from their trucks and cars are typically doing so in an aggressively hostile manner that is disrespectful to this symbolic representation of the openness, diversity, and generosity that is the American nation at its best. Which reminds me of the great Jewish comedian Robert Klein, a multiple past guest of Too Jewish. That means he was here multiple times. And Robert Klein's humorous take on a kid's view of the dangerous that false experience of symbolic supposed patriotism can, well, be.
I remember once the kid who carried the American flag dropped it by accident. He tripped. I assume it was an accident. Who knows? Maybe a communist stuck his foot out. You know. Tripped him. Yeah, they do that. You know, they send their kids and they go into the thing, trip them, yay, mal. They give the signal. And they give the special communist handshake. But the kid dropped the American flag. And it blew his mind. Because they imbued the flag with a special power beyond itself. Like, you know, who knows? He started to bend down and kiss the little gold fringes on the side, those little titsis things, you know what I'm saying? Under the approving eye of an adult teacher. That's it. Kiss the broadcloth. Very nice. You know. Give it a nice kiss. That'll make everything all better, you know. Children fantasize. Somebody like George Washington's going to pop out. Hey, you'll drop me! After all I suffered at Valley Forge, you little Jew boy! They wouldn't let me say Jew boy in the Tonight Show. You know, NBC, they got uptight. I get too many letters from Alabama. Say, why'd you say Jew bastard?
That was Robert Klein's 1950s experience of super patriotism in America. But back to the deep and positive involvement of Jews from the earliest stages of American history, the Revolutionary War, the creation of the United States. In a way, this seems like an important subject to reflect on, maybe more important now than it has been for some time. We Jews have long viewed America as a unique nation of opportunity that guaranteed religious freedom from its founding. We have flourished here in the United States as much as we ever have in any nation during our extraordinarily long history as a people. After suffering religious persecution at the hands of governments all around the world for thousands of years, it has been our privilege to enjoy true freedom here. We have been blessed by the ability to create thriving, vibrant, vital American Jewish life from colonial times up to today. America has been a golden land of acceptance and opportunity for Jews in so many ways for nearly three centuries. And in spite of the rising tides of both right and left-wing anti-Semitism these days, America remains one of the two best places in the world to be Jewish. Israel, of course, is the other best place, and there are many advantages and some disadvantages to being Jewish in both countries. But the ability to be openly, proudly Jewish remains a central privilege of life in both nations. So tomorrow we enjoy the 4th of July and celebrate our religious freedom to be Jews. And as long as we are doing traditional American things on the 4th, I highly recommend using kosher hot dogs, since frankly, they taste better and are responsible to a higher authority, as that old commercial once said.
Government regulations say we can make our Hebrew National beef hot dogs from frozen beef. We don't. The government says we can use artificial coloring. We don't. They say we can add meat byproducts. We don't. They say we can add non-meat fillers. We can't. We're kosher and have to answer to an even higher authority.
Our guest this morning, Dr. James Weiner, is the son of a famous Chicago-area rabbi, and he knows quite a bit about what it's like to grow up in a large shadow of a great man. His new book, The Quest for Legitimacy, How Children of Prominent Families Discover Their Unique Place in the World, explores that exact issue with fascinating conclusions. Find out what they are when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guest this morning, Dr. James Weiner, who is the author of a new book, The Quest for Legitimacy, How Children of Prominent Families Discover Their Unique Place in the World. He is the son of a prominent Skokie, Illinois rabbi in the Chicago area who did important things and has gone on, well, to a very different career. Tell us a little bit about speaking as a fellow RK, which is what we call rabbis' kids. Christians call them PKs, preachers' kids. Tell us how that shaped your early life a little bit.
You know, it's a fascinating question because I grew up with a father who helped the first black family move into Skokie, who was there during the Nazi march into Skokie, and helped make sure that it was handled in a way that didn't cause conflict, founded a camp and a library, and all of that's wonderful. But I also grew up feeling like, can I ever live up to what he set as a model?
So with that as a model, was there an expectation in your family that you would follow in your dad's footsteps?
My dad walked a tightrope, so I think he would have loved it. On the other hand, I think from a very progressive perspective, he didn't do what his parents did, and he wanted me to have the opportunity to choose to do what I wanted to do, even though he kind of watched me struggle to figure it out. And at one point, I did go back and get a degree in Jewish studies.
Which is, close. Your dad, and I don't want to focus too much just on that, because the story, the book actually is extensive and explores sort of the whole way that people emerge from the shadows of important parents to become their own people. But your dad was a founder of Oling Sang Ruby, which is a famous camp in the Reform movement. Were you awed by him growing up, or was he just your dad?
One day he would be just my dad, and the next day he would be somebody who awed me. I tell a story in the book of being probably 3 or 4 year old kid. It's a family service, and a couple rows in front of me, my father had to walk from behind the ark to get out, and he's in his robes, and a kid a couple rows up from me says, Mom, is that God? And it was moments like that I would feel awed by who my dad was.
We will talk much more with Dr. James Weiner, who did a lot of things besides be his dad's son, about the entire issue of what it means to grow up with a prominent parent and see how that develops as we continue to explore his book, The Quest for Legitimacy. We come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this summer. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary safely and in person. Call 520-276-5675 for more information. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us in person Friday night or Saturday morning or both. You can email me directly, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or come every Friday night on our Facebook page. Shabbat evening celebration services are at 6:30 p.m. Shabbat morning services are at 10 a.m. Saturday, all with me leading them, preceded at 9 a.m. by Torah study. Facebook page is BeitSimchaTucson, Beit Simcha Tucson. Our services with full music are available in person and virtually. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. You can access those through our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson, or email me, rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org. Our wonderful religious school is available in blended format, too. Some students live, some on Zoom. For more information about Beit Simcha, to attend services, our fabulous religious school and Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy classes, which are taught live and on Zoom, and of course all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest-growing Jewish congregation in all of Arizona in its exciting beginning years. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and A. Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or a criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email me at toojewishradio18@gmail.com, toojewishradio18@gmail, or go to our website, toojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, toojewishradio.com, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in North America, according to Moment Magazine, over 175,000 Podbean downloads. Please post a rating, review Too Jewish wherever you listen to our podcasts. Those comments make a difference. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about the Jewish community of Libya, traced it from, boy, really antique times up till through the Shoah, the Holocaust, and the arrival of a lot of Libyan Jews in Rome. Let's catch up with what's happened since, well, 1967.
So in 1967, there was the Six-Day War, where, you know, an overwhelming number of Arab countries attacked Israel, and Israel dealt them a crushing defeat, which was humiliating. And almost nowhere in the Arab world did the popular anger rise to the level that it did in Libya. There were really violent pogroms. Jews barricaded themselves into their homes, not for a few hours or a few days, but for weeks till they ran out of food. And here's an almost miraculous thing that happened. And this, by coincidence, happened just over a month ago, and I read about it in Haaretz. Huh. And it was the Association of Libyan Jews in Rome sponsored an evening at a posh hotel to honor the employees of Alitalia, which is the now defunct Italian national airline
right.
that no longer exists, who had rescued...
I flew Alitalia a few times.
All of us have.
Good coffee. That's what I'd say.
The employees, and particularly the manager and assistant manager of the Tripoli office of Alitalia, collectively saved during a period of just a few days in 1967, more than 2,500 Libyan Jews. They sneaked them out of the country. They displaced other passengers. They made excuses to cancel other people's reservations. They not only filled the planes, they offloaded baggage from the baggage compartment and allowed Jews to fly in the baggage compartment to save more.
Save lives.
And what's so interesting about this ceremony that took place recently is people who were either the perpetrators of this kindness and life-saving or the recipients remembered firsthand, obviously. And turns out that most of the Alitalia employees who were involved never told even their closest relatives about this.
Huh.
And their spokesperson, who was the deputy manager at the time, the most senior one still living, a guy named Vaccarini, said, you know, didn't seem then, and it doesn't seem now, like an act of heroism. It just seemed like the right thing to do, and we didn't have a choice. These were human beings. They were in immediate danger of being killed. We did what we could to save them. Well, above and beyond that, the Alitalia staff realized that Jews couldn't transfer any assets out, so they allowed them to buy expensive tickets to faraway places like Rio and Buenos Aires and Los Angeles, whatever. And then as soon as they got to Rome safely, they canceled the seats and refunded the tickets so that they had capital to start their new lives in Rome with, which was an incredibly original way of transferring money out of the country.
Yeah.
And then in the case of the most senior guy, who is no longer among the living, his wife, his daughter, and his grandchildren were there. And one of the senior Jews who was saved in this operation addressed the family collectively and said, "Because of your father, we are all still here, and we will never forget." And it was an extremely moving ceremony presided over the guy who normally gives out the awards at the Venice Film Festival.
At the Biennale. So, yeah.
So there was like a lot of pomp and circumstance and a belated recognition 55 years after the event.
Wow.
Of the heroism of these Alitalia employees.
Boy, I will think about Alitalia in a much better way forever after. May it rest in peace. That's a great story, Tom. And a beautiful connection to an ancient and important community in Libya. Thank you so much.
I look forward to next time.
We will talk then. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew. Brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Morris and Becky are chatting one night. Morris says, "Becky, it's our 50th wedding anniversary soon. Tell me, have you ever been unfaithful?" Becky hesitates for a moment, then says, "Yes, darling, I must admit, after all these years, I was unfaithful 3 times. 3 times? Morris asks. "How did this happen?" "Well, Morris, you remember you lost your job a year after we married, and we had no money, and we thought we might have to sell the house. You remember I went to see the banker to ask for a loan? Well, we got the loan, and that's when it happened." "It's hard to accept," Morris says, "but you did this for us. I can forgive you. What was the second time?" So Becky says, "You remember years later, you almost died from your heart problem. We couldn't afford the open heart surgery. Remember that immediately after I went to see the surgeon at his house, he did the operation for nothing? Well, that's when it happened." "Yes," Morris said, "that shocks me too. But since you did it because you love me, I forgive you, Becky. But tell me, what was the third time?" And Becky answers, "You remember, Morris, when you were trying to get elected president of the temple, and you needed just 12 more votes?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, a special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And really, I didn't write it. It's an old joke. And now a word of Torah. This week in the book of Numbers, we read the odd ritualistic Torah portion of Chukat, the rites of the red heifer. To achieve true ritual purity, ancient Jews were required to find a completely unblemished young female red cow, slaughter it, burn it to ash, mix the ashes with water to create a water of purification in which to wash away ritual impurity. While many elements in the sacrificial code of our ancestors seem odd or alien, this could be the strangest of all the rituals. For it turns out that the red heifer, the Para Aduma, makes the one who is washed in its water pure, but it makes everyone else who comes into contact with it impure. The mystery of this is complete. Commentators have struggled with its meaning ever since the Torah was given. Just what is it that makes the red heifer the right animal to bring purity to the people? And why does it make you pure if you use it properly, but make you impure when you prepare it? The classic answer to the first question is that God ordains the use of a red heifer as a symbolic reversal of the episode of the golden calf. If the people sinned by praying to an idol of a calf, then the very real slaughter and burning of an actual cow and the use of its ashes might well atone for that transgression. Still, why should the process of making something that cleanses us ritually simultaneously make others unclean? Perhaps the answer is also symbolic. The process of bringing holiness into our world is never easy. Working in the field of holiness creation isn't simple. When you toil in the vineyards of the Lord, there's a tendency for the muck that always exists in this world to attach itself to you. When we seek to bring purity into the lives of others, we stand a good chance of exchanging some of our own sanctity for a bit of the grime that stubbornly persists in most people's existence. The complex reversal of holiness in a sacred cow like the red heifer symbolizes the way in which we can only bring sanctity and purity at a certain price. When we acknowledge that price, accept it, learn to cleanse ourselves ritually afterwards, we replenish our ability to help and heal others. When we come back on Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Dr. James Weiner, tells us how he found his own purpose in life after growing up in his dad's shadow, and what helps other children of successful parents do the same. Hear all about it when we come back in a moment on Two Jewish.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett will not run in his country's upcoming elections this fall after serving as head of a fragile, now collapsed Knesset coalition for a little over a year. That, by the way, is the shortest run for an Israeli prime minister in history. The announcement caught many in Israel by surprise, given that Bennett led the country for just a year and as the leader of the right-wing Yamina party would likely have won a role in any future government coalition, a significant one. He indicated in his final speech to the Knesset that he would continue to support Yair Lapid, his foreign minister, set to assume the prime ministership on an interim basis this week. I don't intend to compete in the upcoming elections, but I will remain a loyal soldier in the service of this country, said Bennett. Bennett will continue to serve as alternate prime minister under Lapid's caretaker government, which begins as soon as the Knesset holds its formal vote to dissolve the government and ends when a new coalition forms after the next elections in October or November. These will be Israel's fifth elections in just over 3 years, exacerbating the country's ongoing political stalemate and providing ousted Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu an opportunity to try to retake power as he continues to face multiple corruption charges. Bennett's coalition, which held a one-seat majority in the Knesset, very narrow, ended after two defections, and political observers speculate Netanyahu's behind-the-scenes gamesmanship was to blame. Well, you know, it was. Bennett previously hinted his interest in leaving politics following the coalition's collapse. He was, after all, a highly successful businessman before entering politics. Bennett also named a rising right-wing political star, Interior Minister Ayelet Shaked, as the new head of Yamina. Polls indicate Netanyahu will have to win Yamina back to his side to retake the Knesset. As Yair Lapid and other Israeli politicians thanked Bennett for his service, the country's first new head of state in 15 years leaves behind a kind of mixed legacy. He made repairing relationships with American Democrats a top priority of his after more than a decade of Netanyahu's cozying up to the Republican Party. He became the first Israeli prime minister to visit the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain in the wake of the Abraham Accords brokered under Netanyahu. Bennett also invited into his government successfully the only Arab party ever to serve in the Israeli government. But Bennett showed little interest in reopening talks with the Palestinian Authority, saying Israel wasn't focused on them, true enough. And, of course, he was unable to keep his government going for more than just barely one precarious year. Though Bennett built his political name on the support of religious settlers, his government collapsed when the Knesset failed to extend a law granting full Israeli legal rights to settlers in the occupied West Bank and military control over the Arabs there, after political manipulation by Bibi Netanyahu created the crisis. In other news, Rabbi David Weiss Halivni, a theologian, beloved teacher of Talmud, and pioneering and sometimes controversial scholar, died last week at the age of 94 in Israel. A Holocaust survivor himself, Halivni earned his doctorate and taught for many years at Jewish Theological Seminary, the Conservative Seminary in New York, until leaving the institution in 1983 over its decision to ordain women rabbis. Weiss Halivni later became dean of the Rabbinical School of Union for Traditional Judaism, a movement created by rabbis and scholars specifically that broke with the conservative movement on the issue of female ordination. Rabbi Weiss HaLivni was best known as a champion of the source-critical approach to studying Talmud, treating the vast compendium of Jewish law and lore not as a seamless, unassailable work, but as a tradition layered with variant readings and textual strata altered in transmission. For 1,000 years, Jews studied the Talmud and did not question its authenticity as a faithful record, HaLivni said. Statements were attributed to scholars living 2,000 years earlier, but rarely did anyone ask how these statements had come down to the present. While traditionalists felt that his approach, laid out in his multi-volume opus Mikorot Umisorot, Sources and Traditions, trampled on the domain of the divine, HaLivni insisted his work was in line with an unbroken chain of rabbis and scholars who contributed to a living canon of Jewish text. Our work in life is to make room for God's presence in all our endeavors, said Weiss HaLivni. God's revelation needs constantly to be reinterpreted and concretized, for man's expression of God's law is ambiguous. Beautiful phrase. David Weiss was born in 1927 in Czechoslovakia, but was raised in Sighet, Romania, the same hometown as Elie Wiesel, a lifelong friend. Recognized as an Elui, a boy genius, he was ordained a rabbi at the age of 15. When Nazis seized the town in March 1944, he was sent first to Auschwitz and then to Wolfsburg and Mauthausen concentration camps. He was the only member of his family to survive the Holocaust. He took the additional name HaLivni to differentiate himself from the many Nazi guards with the names of Weiss. In his 1966 memoir, The Book and the Sword, and the 2007 book, Breaking the Tablets, Weiss HaLivni laid out his justification for observing Torah and praying to God despite the horrors of the Holocaust. He rejected suggestions the Holocaust was divine punishment for the Jews' purported sins. Rather, he wrote, God restrained himself from taking part in history and gave humanity an opportunity to display its capacities for good and for evil. It is our misfortune that in the time of the Shoah, humanity displayed its capacities for unprecedented evil. Weiss HaLivni became a naturalized U.S. citizen in 1952. He got his doctorate from JTS in 58 and went on to teach, of course, at JTS, the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, Bar-Ilan University, and Harvard Law School. Associated with Columbia University for 35 years, where he taught from 1986 until 2005. A giant of 20th century scholarship, Rabbi David Weiss HaLivni's work will continue to influence Jewish knowledge for generations. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back the Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Dr. James Weiner, is a psychologist, Psychology Today contributor, and an accomplished family and private wealth consultant. I'm not sure how that fits in with psychology, but we could touch on that, whose new book is called The Quest for Legitimacy, How Children of Prominent Families Discover Their Unique Place in the World. We started talking earlier about your dad, the famous Rabbi Weiner of Skokie, who helped integrate the area, who prevented the Nazi march from becoming violent, really, in a lot of ways, working behind the scenes, and what it was like, co-founder of Olin Sang Ruby Camp, a very prominent reform camp in the Midwest, and what it was like growing up in that setting. As you noted, your dad came from a very different background, right? His parents weren't rabbis.
Yeah, my dad was born in Dresden. He grew up in a family with a father who sort of magically opened a clothing department store that had a couple branches. He was his father was not an observant Jew in any way, secular Jew. And my dad growing up at one point became kosher and couldn't meet in his parents' house. So I don't know much more about that story other than that was the beginning of him making a change from what the world he grew up in.
And then his own journey took him. He was ordained in Germany, came by way of boat, I think you said from India, all the way around in the 1930s, and ended up a prominent rabbi in Chicago. What are the challenges in choosing a different course if everybody looks at you? You know, you were the kid who came out with a toy guitar during services at camp. Was there an expectation from other people, or could you sort of find your own path?
You know, expectations, kind of an interesting word. I remember a lot of times people who I didn't know would come up and rub my hair and say, "I remember you when you were knee high to a grasshopper," whatever that was supposed to mean. The camp, you know, Elie Wiesel taught one summer at camp. I actually was just back there a couple weeks ago. There was clearly my people who admired my father. My peers growing up were extremely comfortable having conversations with him, and he and I struggled to find ways to really be able to communicate with each other.
As a psychologist, you became a psychologist, you've dealt with other people who've gone through kind of the same experience, admiring their parents, finding difficulty. You know, it's not unusual for adolescents to have trouble talking to their dads or moms who are accomplished people. What common themes have you seen with other people in this sort of setting?
So that kind of leads me into talking about the research behind the book. Over the last 4.5 years, I've interviewed Rising Gen family members from around the globe, some of them from extremely prominent families, some prominent in a smaller realm. One of the things that we discovered a path that was common, but we also discovered that every one of them at one point in their life went through a breaking moment, a moment where their plans were interrupted by something, and they've gone through periods afterwards of what I call liminality, a feeling betwixt and between, which requires them to sort out who they are and how are they going to take ownership of their own lives.
How do people do that? How do they come to that determination? I know that's a complicated question.
So probably my answer to that is the path that we found. In the shortest version, at the first point, there's some moment of awareness. So the story I told you about being in the sanctuary and another kid asking, "Is that God?" For me, it was a moment of, "Oh my God, I'm different than everybody else." And it's an awareness. The second part is you begin to get a little bit more exposure from the world, but you're very connected. And so for me, I would go to Shrewey, to the camp in Wisconsin. It was a place that I could remain Jewish, but it was also a place that I began to get exposure to a lot of other influences and other rabbis and other people who are thought leaders, including Elie Wiesel. And that began part of sorting out who I was, followed by a period of exploration was when I began to move away. For me, that period was a very challenging period. I think it is for a lot of the people we interviewed. And at some point, if you can do it, you need to be able to define who you are and figure out how you're going to take ownership of your own life. And that's kind of an overview of what we experience.
So you talk about the break with liminality, and instead of being, you know, in the shadow of or part of this larger circle of accomplishment or experience of a overwhelming parent, maybe the best way to put it. Does it require a sharp break for someone to find their own place?
So So we found a range, everything from a gentleman who had spent a number of years working in his family's business, was entrepreneurial in his own right, and one day he was coming home from the World Cup, and he received an email that basically said that he was fired. It wasn't put that way, but he did almost a two-year break with his family, where he didn't talk to his mom and dad until he had recast what he wanted to do and got a position as a professor. And it was very important for him to go knock on his parents' door, and was glad that his father's response, who was Indian, was, I'm so glad you're here, but I wouldn't have been the one to reach out. And it changed the nature of the relationship. And we had a couple examples of people who were supported all the way through their search, stayed close with their families. So it doesn't require a break, but a break can exist.
I'll tell a story about my own dad that I don't talk about much. My grandfather taught at Hebrew Union College for 35 years, so, and actually founded the congregation that merged into the congregation that became your dad's congregation at one point. So it's very funny how small the Jewish world can be. But my grandmother always wanted him to follow in my grandfather's footsteps. He didn't want to do that. And at one point, she had him come in, and he agreed that he was going to go to Hebrew Union College to study to become a rabbi, which he did not do. He went on to do a variety of other things. But there was tremendous parental pressure to do that. And his break was he moved to California and got into the movie industry. And then eventually became a cantor and later got ordained an Orthodox rabbi. So it's a funny circle in a weird way. But there can be, of course, a lot of pressure to follow in those footsteps, even if that wasn't your personal experience. In the research that you did as a psychologist, how frequent was it that parents really did pressure their kids to follow in their footsteps?
So I would love to divide the pressure into two kinds. One, the very direct pressure that you described, where somebody says, this is what I want you to do. And you can imagine if you own a big family business, when we talk to some people with global businesses, there is a lot for a lot of them, the expectation that they find a role in the business. The second pressure, which was more than what I experienced, was it's just this world that you're born into, and you need to make a decision about what part you're going to take in that world. And for me, certainly the model was to become a rabbi or take a significant role in the Jewish community. I just didn't want to be in the bubble. I watched what it was like to be in the bubble. So that's sort of how I took something close and became a psychologist rather than becoming a rabbi, even though I'm finding myself in a different bubble at this point.
In your research, you find people who've grown up in extremely privileged families, financially privileged with lots of opportunities, that can become a straitjacket. It can become, you know, a launching pad. Tell us what the distinctions are.
One of the examples that I have was we interviewed Henry Kaiser, who was the grandson of the founder of Kaiser Industries, that built the Hoover Dam.
All the Liberty ships that Kaiser constructed, and you know, all kinds of legacies in construction and development all around the country.
Three generations later, the wealth wasn't there, but he felt that his whole life was, growing up, was in preparation for a special role. He was about to get married, found out that his grandfather was sick and was probably not going to live long enough to meet, to be able to be there at his wedding. So he meets with his grandfather in the conference room at Kaiser Center, and they can't figure out how to have a conversation about whether there's a role for him or not. And in some ways, as wealthy and as big as that was, the story bears some similarities to me and other people who've grown up in families that are prominent but aren't as wealthy as that family was.
One more question. I feel like we could talk about this for a long time. You talk about the quest, kind of the inner journey that people have to go on to move beyond their origin. Isn't that true for everybody?
I think that's such a great question. My research focused on a subset, but I also worked at Cook County Jail for 4.5 years. So I've worked with the full range economically and culturally. And, you know, a lot of the people who were in the jail were people who were looking for some way to find a way out and took the wrong path, took the wrong turn. Of course, they were standing trial, so they weren't, you know, they were detainees, so they weren't all guilty. But I think everybody struggles to rise above the circumstances that they've been born with.
I want to thank Dr. Jamie Weiner for his new book, The Quest for Legitimacy, How Children of Prominent Families Discover Their Unique Place in the World. I think it's a great book for people of prominent and other families, everybody trying to kind of figure out how they got to where they got to, not just for next-gen people, but even for aging baby boomers like some of the rest of us. Where can people go to find out more about you, Dr. Weiner?
So there's two places. One, the book is available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And then I have a website called The Quest for Legitimacy, and I'd love to have people go there.
Thank you so much. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Professor Boaz Devir, Director of the Holocaust, Genocide, and Human Rights Education Initiative at Penn State University, a revolutionary new way to teach teachers how to advance real learning and understanding in their classrooms using Holocaust materials and media as a means to that end. It's a fascinating and important project. He's a dynamic and excellent guest. Don't miss it. And don't forget, join us at Congregation Beit Simcha in person every Friday night for services at Oneg Shabbat starting at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush, live in person and available on our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson. Our playout this morning comes from Doug Kotler, his silly and fun Jewish USA Beach Boys parody for the 4th of July. My friends, have a great 4th. Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of peace.
If everybody had a Torah across the USA, then everybody'd be Jewish like you and me today. Everybody was Jewish, Jewish USA. You'd see a Jew in the White House and in the NBA, racing in the 500, running the NRA. There's no more races and no more KKK.
Everybody was Jewish. both be the same. And even Pat Buchanan would want to change his name if everybody was.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.